We're in Romans, and we're still in the first chapter of our study in Romans, the first lesson, and in the first chapter of Romans, the first 17 verses of the book of Romans. As we have talked before, this is a typical letter for Paul in some ways, and yet non-typical in others, and it's one of the last ones he wrote, but as we mentioned the other week, it's listed first because it's the longest. When the church decided to do the letters of Paul, they did them from longest to shortest, not chronologically. We find Paul dealing with basic points of theology in the first seven verses, which is the longest of his openings of any of his letters as well. And last time we talked some about the whole idea of a diatribe. Paul tends to use that form of argument where you put questions on the lips of an objector or a straw man, and then you answer the questions. You've got the answers, and you formulate the questions almost like being on Jeopardy, I guess. But when you're doing that, you already know the answers that you want to get out there, and so you formulate the questions and put them on the lips of someone out here, which generally is a straw man, someone out here that asks you the question, or you ask it through them, and then you answer the question. In other words, you've already got the answer figured out, or at least what you want to say as an answer figured out. And that's kind of how he does this. Now, when Paul talks about the Old Testament, he always paraphrases or quotes, not the Hebrew text, which is really kind of interesting since he was raised a Pharisee or trained as a Pharisee. But he always quotes the Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Hebrew text, which sometimes can have some slightly different nuances since the Septuagint is Greek and has that Hellenistic kind of understanding to it. And when he talks about law, he's not specifically speaking of Torah as sin and death, but he speaks of the law as a code that governs a community and the individual both. So the law is not just something that, it's not like the Ten Commandments and we boom, 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 but it's a larger kind of code that governs a community and the individual. It's a set of principles that he uses here. And so that's kind of where we were last time. And we were talking about what was Paul's calling or what was his task, and how is that calling? And one of the questions that I think is in your book toward the end is, how is that calling different? Is Paul's calling any different than yours or mine? Shoot, I don't even need my glasses to read this. Thank y'all. But, you know, calling. Calling has three components. What are those three components? Page 32. Okay, a divine summons. And similar to, as he says, a father calling a child, boy, get over here. Or son, come over here. So it's a divine summons coming from an authority figure, in particular like a father calling a son. Divine summons is not a question. Would you like to come over here? Or how about come over here? It's, boy, you better get over here. It's a command. Okay? What's the second part of the biblical calling? Okay. It's a calling, an effectual calling. What that means is it's a calling which is the process by which you are prepared by God for a particular purpose or a particular task. Okay? What's the third part? Commissioning, being sent out with a message. That's where we get to the whole idea of an apostle, one who is sent with a message. A disciple is one that studies or sits at the feet and studies, whereas an apostle is someone specifically sent out for a message. So those are the three basic parts of a calling, especially as you see it in the biblical text. So Paul receives that call. In some ways, Paul's calling, what would you see as the first step in Paul's calling?
I thought
Yeah. Damascus. Yeah. Now he didn't have. Well, he could have said no, but. But that calling, yeah, that calling for Paul actually had two parts to it, though.
Yeah.
The first part of that calling was meeting Jesus on the road to Damascus and becoming blinded. The second part of that calling was when Ananias came to him and said, God has said he's setting you apart, and something like scales fell from his eyes and he was commissioned at that point. So Paul's initial calling, that, hey boy, I'm going to get your attention here, get on over here, had two parts to it. The second part of that calling was his preparation, where he had been prepared as a Pharisee and knowing a lot of other philosophies, that continued in all of those years that he spent after he left Jerusalem. He went to Tarsus and spent time preparing himself, arguing, debating with other philosophers, etc. And then he is commissioned. He's sent out and he goes out. He starts churches. He writes letters to those churches. He goes out and picks fights, for lack of a better way to describe it. He goes out and picks fights with the opposition. And so, you know, he does all of this this kind of stuff as he goes along. Now, in his opening then, let me ask this. How is that calling any different than yours or mine? Is it different? Okay.
Probably the most awesome calling ever.
And a lot of folks, it's not quite as, you know, don't have that, in fact, that Damascus Road kind of experience, you know, where, or maybe a better description, where you're going down the road about 50 miles an hour and all of a sudden somebody slams it into reverse and pops a clutch. You know, that's that Damascus Road kind of experience. Or you knock it into reverse, on an automatic. You ever done that? Driven, you're still moving forward and you just happen to nudge and hit that and it goes through neutral and hits reverse. It kind of shakes and grinds a little bit. Okay. It was just kind of a little more different, a little more subtle. And I was a biology major and had plans. You know, I was raised in church, did all kinds of things. I laughed at my grandfather on my father's side when I ended up being the minister in youth week one time and had to do my first sermon. And he said, "You're going to be a preacher one day." I said, "Nope." And I was doing great in biology and planning on being a surgeon. And I took my first religion class, took New Testament before Old Testament, and had Chris White for a professor. And by the end of that class, I changed my major to religion major and said, "This is what I want to do." So for me, it was just kind of something clicked. And as much as I love biology and still do, you know, folks who know me know that when I go to the National Cancer Institute or the American Heart Association or the health.gov kinds of things and go to read the things, I don't read the patient version. I read the doctor's version of all those kinds of things. So I still keep up with that. But it was just kind of that way. I heard your question a while ago. So. It wasn't this big light. It was just kind of this in the back of my mind. I said, "This is interesting. This is what I want to do." Believe it or not, coming through school, I mean, I did fine in speech class and all that, but I wasn't one that did a whole lot of stand up and talking to folks. But then that started, and I hadn't shut up since. No, it's just kind of along, and in some ways it was different, but in other ways I guess it was similar because I was heading in one direction and got paired off in another, but it wasn't one of these rip you out of your frame kind of things like it was with Paul. But that doesn't necessarily mean that we don't have callings. Some people just kind of get to the point and you teach Sunday school. How'd you get to that point? Yes, I'm looking at you. You're the only one on that back row that teaches Sunday school. Debbie, you teach Sunday school. Robert?
I told him before about going on a mission trip to Panama. You know, when he started getting that together, I sat in the pew. I still sit up. And then there's something telling me to go. Get up and go. Get up and go. And I've done sat there for weeks with that same feeling. I'd go back the next Sunday and still do that same.
Get up and go.
You know, but finally.
Yeah, it's just that feeling or that nag in the back of you, in the back of your head.
Yeah.
And like Debbie said, you just kind of start early and just kind of work into it. You know, so for some folks, it's that jerk almost tear you apart kind of situation, like with Paul. And for others, it's just a little more subtle. But that doesn't negate the call, and that doesn't mean that Paul's call was greater than anybody else's call. It's just the mode by which it happened and then what he did with it. He became as much a pain for the other side as he had been for the Christians when he came along. So, you know, so here we go with Paul looking at this, and he talks about he gives them this greeting, grace you and peace, and he talks about this gift. And the gift for him is this gift of grace. This gift of grace. He also says that all readers, all of these readers, are called by Jesus Christ or called to belong to Jesus. You know, he goes through all of this basic theology, and through him and for his name's sake, we received grace and apostleship to call people from among all the Gentiles to the obedience that comes from faith. You also are among those who are called. In other words, everybody who reads it, everybody who hears him, everybody who hears even the initial call of God, he said, every one of you is called. It's just a matter of answering that call and to where you are called and to whom you are called. It might be at work. It might be at school. It might be that ornery person in your family that you can't stand to be around. Yeah. Any number of places. So everyone has a calling, and a calling to share that good news in one way or another. And in fact, he even says in verse 7, he's writing it to all loved by God and called to be hagioi, saints. Holy ones is a literal translation of the word. Holy ones. Everyone is called by Jesus. Now, Paul says that he also has been called to be, in some translations, it says he is called to be a servant. Others, he's called to be a slave. Is there a difference in being the servant of Christ or slave of Christ? Doulos. Well, it's possible. I mean, we can't get inside Paul's mind, but he does mention in the letter to the Galatians, you know, that whole thing about his eyesight. He said, you know, I know that some of you would have given your eyes to me if it would have helped. And I think his thorn in the flesh was probably the fact that he never totally regained his eyesight from that. So, you know, he may have felt a stronger emphasis because he went blind and then he gets his sight back. And, you know, all of that surrounding this call. But what does it take to be a servant? What does it take to be a slave? You have to do what? Submit. You do what the master says. You submit. It's and when he uses the word here, And in fact, in a couple of places where it says servant, it's actually doulos, which is slave. It's not diakonos, servant. And here in chapter 1, he uses the word doulos for slave. It's a submissive form. What it means is you have been marked for service. Paul recognized he had been marked for service. Now, we talked before about servants and slaves and, you know, the whole idea that if you were a slave or a servant and then your 7 years was up, but hey, you got married to another slave after 3 years, now they got 4 more years, well, you could either leave or you could sign back up again. And eventually it gets to the point to where you sign up enough times and you commit yourself and you want to work for that master and you said, we're going to work for this master forever. What did they do? How did they mark somebody? That's right, Jerry. They put them against the doorpost and they ran an awl through the ear. And that way, that person was marked as a slave for that, or a servant for that master from that point until they died. Now, Paul didn't have that, but he says that he was marked for service to Jesus. He was a slave. Now, maybe for Paul, the mark was the poor eyesight. But in some ways, though, I think that the mark is more than just a physical kind of thing. That mark is a spiritual kind of thing as well, which marks us for that kind of service. And he wants to give the good news of God and the good news from God. That is, that Jesus Christ is Lord and Jesus Christ was set apart for that. And he uses faith in here, in this beginning. He uses faith to speak of faithful obedience. It's not just believing, but rather acting upon it. Faith for Paul, and in Romans chapter 1, verses 1 through 7, when he talks about faith, he's talking about faith as in faithful obedience. It's not just saying, well, I believe, and I'll pray every now and then, but it's being faithfully obedient to that call every day. That's the hard part, is being faithful to that call every day. The times we don't want to be. The times we get tired. Right? Well, maybe y'all don't, but the times I get tired too. Yeah. There are times in my life, there are days and weeks sometimes that I say, bless you. Come on. Are you sure? Let's give me a break. Cut me some slack here. There are times we run into that, but it's a matter of faith. Is a means, first of all, of access for all nations, but also faith is faithful obedience. And it is linked to obedience here in verse 5. Through him and for his name's sake, we receive grace and apostleship to call people from among the Gentiles, what? To the obedience that comes from faith. The obedience that comes from faith. You cannot separate faith and obedience for Paul. And by faith, some people say, oh, well, faith is belief. I ask folks a lot of times, okay, what is belief? And immediately they'll say, oh, that's having faith. And we'll eventually get into some questions. Okay, are faith and obedience exactly, are faith and belief exactly the same? And a lot of folks say, well, yeah. And then I'll do my little chair thing. I said, I believe that chair will hold me. I believe that chair will hold me. Do I have faith? And immediately, you got faith in. Do I? Really? Do I really have faith in a chair? No. And several times I'll motion to the chair and got faith in. Is that faith? No. That's faith. When you sit down in it without doing a stress test. Faith is acting upon that belief. And for Paul, faith and obedience, that belief and obedience, go together. Acting upon that belief. That's faith. And so he talks here, to be called, I do this to call you to obedience. Obedience that comes from faith. So that's where he starts all of this. Now, in verses 8 to 15, we have his thanksgiving. Typically begins with thanks. First, I thank my God through Jesus Christ for y'all. It says you all, and he was from Tarsus, which was in the southern part of Asia Minor, so you can say y'all. Paul says, I thank my God for y'all. Why? Because your faith is being reported all over the world. And that faith, once again, is not. Once again, he's not started this church. He's never been to this church. But he says, I thank God because I'm hearing about your faith. Well, does that mean that he's hearing about them talking about they believe? No. He's hearing about how they've proven their faith, how they've been obedient to God and to God's call, and how they have proven their faith. He doesn't speak of the Roman church of being in need of correction, but rather, he thanks them for the expression of faith which has been noticed. I mean, he hadn't been there to hear them. He hadn't sent Timothy to find out about them. He's heard about them already in the Roman Empire. Why? Because they've been noticed. The way they live their lives in a faithful obedience to God, they've been noticed. Their reputation has spread. They're not deficient in faith. He says, your faith is being reported all over the world. God, whom I serve with my whole heart in preaching the gospel of his Son, is my witness. How constantly I remember you in my prayers. And I pray that now, at last, by God's will, the way may be opened for me to come to you. And we know that part of that was to impart more grace and more teaching. Part of that was to take up a collection to take to the church at Jerusalem so he can get back in the good graces of James and Simon Peter and some others. Because he had been kind of on the outs with them at this particular point in time. But he also wants to reap. He wants to give them the gift of deeper insight. I long to see you so that I may impart to you some spiritual gift to make you strong. That is, that you and I may be mutually encouraged by each other's faith. Okay? The gift he wants to give them is deeper insight. That's why he diatribes and everything else. He wants to give them deep. Not enough to stay on the surface. He wants to teach them the deeper things. He wants to challenge them with those things. That's why Paul is never an easy read. Right? Paul is never an easy read. He is convinced the only way to truly fulfill one's calling is not just to say, and there were a lot of folks who did this, they'd come to redemption, they'd come to salvation, and then in no time they'd immediately be out running around and telling other people, and that was okay, except all of a sudden they started telling them from the religion out of which they had just come, or out of a lack of understanding, and some of the heresies and some of the other teachings that were getting out there that had to be combated were because of that. People didn't take the time to put down deep roots to really study and to learn, but they immediately started running out and telling others. And so Paul wants to give them deeper insight so that not only may they be strong, but he said that you and I may be mutually encouraged by each other's faith. He said, when I see that, I hope you'll be encouraged by the wisdom and the insight and the faith that I show, the commitment, he says, as a slave of Christ. But at the same time, you, by learning more and by doing more, will encourage me to keep on doing what I'm doing. So it's mutual encouragement to do that. Okay? It's not just Paul or for Paul's sake. But it's for all of them, even Paul's sake. For Paul seeming to think sometimes that he's got all the answers worked out, there are times like this that you see a little glimpse into the fact that Paul's still got a few doubts here and there. And he needs that encouragement to help him, to challenge him. And part of Paul's wanting them to challenge him to is Paul liked to fight. I mean, he did. He liked a debate. But he also tried to learn from those debates. If somebody was besting Paul, that meant he'd go back and do more studying and more thinking and reasoning and trying to figure out, okay, how do I really answer this? Paul was one of those that thoroughly believed as long as he was alive, he couldn't learn enough. So he kept doing that. So that's one. And he says, I do not want you to be unaware that I planned many times to come to you, but have been prevented from doing so, in order that I might have a harvest among you just as I have among other Gentiles. Okay, well, what is that harvest? The collection. Just as I have among other, he wants to get that collection. That's the harvest of fruit. There were four motivations for his wanting to preach in Rome. People need the gospel, first and foremost. I thought about breaking into a chorus of people need the Lord, but we won't do that. But people need God. The love for God, his love for God compelled him to do it. He couldn't. And I think you're right in on many counts, Ed, that once he was converted and once he accepted that call, the rest of his life, even when he would fall, the rest of his life was trying to do what he could, make sure he was doing more and more for God, trying to do, in some ways, do penance. Third, he was convinced that the gospel changes lives and lives needed to be changed. He knew what was going on in Rome and lives needed to be changed, just like he knew what was going on in Corinth. In Corinth, there was such, I've said before, ISIS, and I think we've said this before, ISIS was the goddess Isis was a major religious cult in the city of Corinth because of the high female population. But Corinth was a sailor's town. In the worst kind of way. We've mentioned ISIS. Yeah, came out of Egypt. Yes, ISIS. Which really kind of, I know they've got other reasons they say for it, but really kind of surprises me that ISIS, with their hatred of anyone that doesn't dominate women, would choose that name when it's the name of a goddess. But Aristophanes, the writer and philosopher, Greek writer and philosopher, coined a word, Corinthia zestai, to speak of Corinth. Corinthia zestai in Greek very simply means to commit fornication. There were more red light districts in Corinth than there are stoplights in Greenville County. So that high female population there. And so he knew the gospel was needed to change lives, not just in Corinth, but in Rome, and with Roman emperor worship and all the other things that were going on. So that was a third reason he wanted to go. And another reason he wanted to go was Paul felt an obligation not only to share the gospel, but also to take up a collection for the poor church in Jerusalem. The church started in Jerusalem and it grew, but then as other churches began, it started getting more and more poor as people went out and started other churches. So he felt this obligation to God for what God had done for him, but he also felt this obligation to help the church in Jerusalem. And I guess the real question that comes up there is what motivates us for being servants? What motivates us to tell folks or to live a certain way? Probably for a lot of folks, what motivates them to live a certain way once they accept Jesus is they don't want to go, as my former student, preacher boy, was talking that day, and I said, well, wait a minute. Why did you make a profession of faith? Because he was talking to this girl and telling her she needed to get right and all this kind of stuff, and she needed to go to the right kind of church with the right kind of preacher, or she was going to go to hell. And I said, and why did you? And he said, because I don't want to go to hell. Come on in. And so, that was a part of, and probably for a lot of folks, if you really ask them, how come you've done this? How come you say you're committed to going to church and to doing this? Because they don't want to go to hell. But that wasn't what Paul said. There's a bigger motivation out there. And here in Romans, he really gives those motivations in this section. I'm obligated both to Greeks and non-Greeks, both to the wise and the foolish. That's why I'm so eager to preach the gospel to even you who are in Rome. So he's trying to do this. He's trying to give them an understanding of why he's doing what he does. So the real question for us then is what motivates us to do it?
Number of years, I've gotten everything I wanted, and I seen some odd miracles, you might say, and things like that, things that shouldn't have happened at the time.
And that's that word a lot of folks don't like. Well, patience, but the other one, the D word, discipline.
Oh, thank you.
Discipline. You know, and are people ashamed of the gospel these days? That's one of those rhetorical questions. Obviously, there's some who at least act like they are, right? They're afraid to share it with certain people. They don't like to talk about it with people who are like them, right? I don't like to talk about it.
The problem is, I think everybody's been. There are very few people, I think, who are ignorant of it. You know, back many years ago, there was this area where a lot of people hadn't heard, be it backwoods or whatever. They've just never been brought up that way. But now, everybody with the media, TV, and everything else, be it good, bad, or ugly. they've been exposed. And you think, well, they've either accepted, not going to accept, they know what it is. And you know, you seem like you've got to wait for them to come to you instead of you go to them.
Well, but I would agree to an extent, yes and no. Have they really been exposed to the gospel proper or other kinds of things that are peripheral? And you'd be surprised. There are a lot of folks who don't get exposed to the gospel anywhere in the world. And if you're talking about the world as a whole, now, talking about South Carolina is a different thing, but the world as a whole, there are still numerous groups that do not have any translation of scriptures in their dialect, even though the Bible's been translated and portions of it into all kinds, you know, thousands of languages and dialects. There's still a lot out there that aren't as well. But Paul's thesis statement comes up in verses 16 and 17 for the whole book of Romans. He's talked about his purpose. He's talked about what he wanted to do. He's talked about having faith, faith which is obedience. But his thesis statement comes here, and this is kind of unique for Paul. It's unique in the book of Romans because he makes this thesis statement, and then the rest of the book, the rest of the letter of Romans, looks back to this thesis statement, and this thesis statement is argued throughout the rest of the letter. For I am not ashamed of the gospel, because it is the power of God for the salvation of everyone who believes, first the Jew, then for the Gentile. For in the gospel, a righteousness from God is revealed, a righteousness that is by faith from first to last, or faith, it is out of faith for faith, literally in the Greek text, out of faith for faith. Just as it is written, the righteous, or some say the just, shall live by faith. And so he gives this thesis statement. And actually, it takes the rest of the letter. This is a very deep statement. It takes the rest of the letter to put it in postmodern terms, computer terms, takes the rest of the letter to unlock the zip file. I hate when somebody sends me a zip file on a computer, because then I got to go and do this and do this to get it to open the zip file. No. But it's a very deep statement. The entire argument that follows gives the basis for his eagerness to speak in Rome. I am not ashamed. Now, that's understatement here, the way Paul puts it. I'm not ashamed of the gospel. We don't give enough glory to God. He's saying, you know, I'm not ashamed. The people who are ashamed aren't giving enough glory to God to do this. What we find here is that the power of God, which is in this gospel, is the strength. And the word for power here in the Greek is dunamis. Dunamis. It has the dunamis to change, to transform. And we said the other, said last week, dunamis, asked what words we get from it, and the upsilon in Greek transliterates to a Y in English, and so it's dynamis. Dynamo, dynamite, you know, power, that kind of power. And so it's that explosive, you know, a dynamo or dynamite is an explosive kind of power. And so the power of God is an explosive kind of power, which allows him to proclaim and which changes lives. Now, the theme of salvation is also central in all of this. You've got the power of God. He's not ashamed of the gospel. The power of God for what? The salvation of everyone who believes. First the Jew, then the Greek, or the Gentile. Anybody that's not Jewish. Here he says the whole goal of the message that he proclaims is soteria, salvation. And for him, in Romans, salvation is not just, hey, I got saved and I got my ticket and I don't have to worry about burning. Right. For Paul, in Romans, salvation is, the purpose of salvation is to belong to God. To belong to the kingdom of God. Not just out there, but here. The purpose of salvation is to belong to the kingdom of God here and to live like we belong to the kingdom of God here. That's the purpose of salvation. Not just to get you out of, you know, and as I've said, if that's the only reason you walk down an aisle was to get that fire insurance policy, that paper is no good. If you don't do something with it, that piece of paper is no good. Okay? Yes, Eric. Yeah, and the power begins working at that point in time. But it is a journey. It's a process.
And I was thinking that maybe it took more than just that one.
Well, that is the power. And that was something different. The interesting thing about that, you know, the Spirit, and for Luke, and really for Paul, and I think Luke gets this some from Paul, Gospel of Luke, the writer of the book of Acts, if it's Luke. But Paul had, but they were together, and the Spirit comes to dwell in the person at the point of true belief. You don't have to get a booster shot later. And it's the power of the Spirit then that begins to work over the journey. Now, it can make a drastic change like it did on the road to Damascus. But even there, he didn't just know it all right then. Paul spends all of these years studying in Tarsus and other places and preparing. So it is a journey, and the power is there, but we have... God gives us the ability to restrict how effective that power is if we don't submit. That's where he talks about the slave in submission. So it is a journey, Ariel, and it's not... And yes, those early Christians, they had the power. You've got the power. It's a matter of... Right. Right. Right.
But there is a transformation sometimes in your life. Like, if you're being transformed by something, you have to be pretty close to it.
And very true. And that's what he will talk about here, too.
I feel like as I journey, that transformation didn't happen overnight. It took a period of 7-8 years.
Well, it does. It takes time. We're still being, you know, and Paul was still being transformed. Paul... for Paul, salvation is not a one and done thing. Paul talks about salvation as past event, as present reality, and as future hope. And he will say, you know, that's why he'll say it's foolishness to those who are perishing. It's good news to we who are being saved. It's a process. It's a process. And he recognized that process, and that's what we've got here, and that's where the Spirit does that. It's not salvation as boom, I got my ticket to ride. There's that initial infusion of the Spirit, but then the transforming power. It's a transformation over time. The dunamis can be explosive. But even with Paul, when it was explosive on the road to Damascus, it took him a long time to finally get. And he was still working on it when he died. So he talks about this power of God for the salvation. For in the gospel, a righteousness from God is revealed. So he links salvation with righteousness. Salvation and the righteousness of God go together. Which he borrows from the court. God is the righteous judge who declares the guilty freed. Why? On the basis of God's righteousness, not because we're so great and wonderful. Yeah. And that's one of the aspects of God's being and God's work to which God is committed. Ernst Käsemann, New Testament theologian, German theologian, said that one of the major aspects of God's being and God's work is this righteousness to which God is committed for us. It's God's righteousness. We are declared free, not because we're so great and wonderful or because we repented enough times. We're declared free because God's righteousness, in God's righteousness, God uses His righteousness to make us free. Then we have to choose whether to accept it or not. And once we accept it, then we have to choose whether to live it or not. And that righteousness makes a difference. And that's the power, the transforming power of that righteousness of God that makes the difference for us. A righteousness that is out of faith for faith. For Paul, the good news is always about faith, not something else. And remember, faith is not simply believing. Faith is obedience, faithful obedience to that call, to what we're called. He points to the dynamic gift, grace and faith and righteousness, and our response, faithful obedience. And throughout the letter, he will talk about obedience, obedience, obedience in faith to that righteousness. And when he says here, faith, it is out of faith for faith, just as written, the righteous. The interesting thing is, it's, you know, and we think, oh, the just shall live by faith. And he's talking about all us Christians who set the example. Not us, not Paul. Literally in the Greek text, it's the righteous one. Ho dikaios, the righteous one. It's speaking about Jesus. Jesus lived by faith and shows us that faith. He is the one who has faith, the ultimate righteousness. Or the ultimate righteous one is Jesus. Therefore, God's righteousness is revealed out of the faith of Jesus, which then leads us into faith and faithful obedience if we follow Him. And that's part of the righteousness of God as well, working within us. And the power of God working within us, and the power of the Holy Spirit working within us, is that we come to the point to where we can truly follow the one who was righteous and is righteous, Jesus, in faithful obedience. It's not our own righteousness. It's a righteousness that comes from God only through Christ. Yeah, Paul emphasizes that new righteousness, which in some ways comes out of Paul's Pharisaic background in talking about righteousness and understanding the righteousness of God. God is judge, and it is God alone who is righteous. And God shows that righteousness and that ultimate faith in Jesus. Yes? You went like this. Okay. There is that, but it's a new, it's not that the righteousness of God is new, but it's been revealed in a newness and a new way. Righteousness of God has always been there. Even Jesus, when Jesus talks about God's righteousness, it comes out of the Old Testament.
I don't know how I could achieve righteousness.
We can't in and of ourselves.
Without Him.
No, we can't.
And that requires a lot of prayer.
And a lot of work.
Yeah.
Yes, sir. Oh, absolutely. But that's what he's saying here. It's not our faith, but it's the faith of Jesus, the righteous one, that's, you know, being God's righteousness being revealed out of the faith of Jesus, which then leads Christians into faith. That's the only way we can survive, ultimately, yes. It's... Right. Yeah. Right. And I wouldn't say it... Yeah. Yeah. But I wouldn't say for me it's sometimes hard. It's oftentimes hard. And it can be very tiring. Not only can it be exhausting for us, sometimes I think we exhaust God. If we could, God's got to be exhausted. Right. It's difficult, and the mind has to be opened. And sometimes you just get it open a crack, and that's all it takes. But sometimes you can, as I told folks a long time ago, if I had to choose a symbol that represented what I do, especially when I teach in college, it'd be a crowbar. Because it takes a crowbar sometimes just to pry a mind open a little bit. And sometimes you need to hit somebody over the head with a crowbar to get their attention. And but you know, it would be a crowbar, because that's what I try to do, is pry a little bit. And sometimes that makes folks cry a lot, but you know, it's not me. It's and you know, I fall short all the time. But the point is that faithful obedience is that we're, even when we fall, we are faithful to be obedient, to get up and keep moving. It does. And that faithful obedience, when we see that the dunamis, the power of God, making transformations, not just in other people's lives, but even in our own lives, when we recognize that, that bolsters hope even more. That maybe somewhere along the line, we've at least got a little bit of handle on it. So, that then brings, I hope that you filled out, and I'm not asking people to, unless you particularly want to, but in the book here, the questions. What is the difference between the gospel bringing salvation and bringing us righteousness? What is the difference in the gospel bringing your salvation and making you righteous? And I don't mean self-righteous. Far too many people are that. And that creates more problems than it solves. But what is it that in that salvation that brings righteousness to you and through you? And that's kind of the thought. Next week we'll go to lesson two. And maybe, I don't know. You know, it's taken us 2 weeks to get through lesson one. I hope not. But if it means fruitful discussion, then so be it. I tell college, I've told my college students and still do. Yeah. Yes, this, I love the word tentative when I put it on the course outline. Tentative outline. I said, you know, I hope we get through all of this stuff. But if we don't get through all of it, that's okay, provided that you remember and we get to what you need to know and you remember it for longer than a test. Yeah, then that's okay. Well, y'all be careful. Thank you. God bless you. Go in peace. And may you find even more of His faithful righteousness and obedience.